Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really interesting corner of the law, looking at this idea of intimidation, specifically in bank robbery.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
You sent over some great material, a podcast script guide, a case brief, and a standard legal brief, all focused on United States v. Burnley. And what immediately jumped out at me is this question. Can you actually rob a bank just by, you know, intimidating someone? Even if you don't explicitly threaten violence.
It's the core question, absolutely. Okay. It feels like there should be more to it, right? Like yelling or waving a weapon.
Exactly. It seems like there's more to it than just, well, being scary without saying scary things. Let's get into this.
You're right, there is. And the Burnley case is a perfect example of how the legal definition of intimidation can really stretch beyond what we might first think. It really highlights that in law, context is often... well, everything. We tend to picture bank robbers making these, you know, overt threats. But Burnley's conviction shows that a more subtle approach can still meet that legal threshold for intimidation.
Okay, so let's set the scene. Walter Burnley himself, what exactly did he do? Lay out the basic facts for us.
Okay. So, Walter Burnley was convicted of 4 bank robberies. These happened in Wisconsin back in April and May of 2006.
4 robberies.
Yeah. And his method was pretty consistent across 3 of those robberies. He'd walk into the bank, sometimes with an accomplice, calmly demand money from a teller.
Calmly?
Relatively calmly, yes. Hand over a bag and then tell them not to include any dye packs or bait bills.
He was actually giving instructions. That's almost polite, isn't it? In a really weird way.
It might sound that way, but that's actually a key point we'll definitely come back to. Now, in the 4th robbery, there was a more direct threat.
Yeah.
Burnley explicitly told a teller he would kill her if she put in a dye pack, so that one's clearer.
Yeah.
But it's those other 3 instances, the ones without the explicit threat, that are really at the heart of this whole discussion about intimidation.
Right. And how did the tellers react in those 3 robberies? The ones without the direct, you know, I'll kill you threat. Did they just hand over the money?
They did. They complied in all the cases. However, some of the tellers later testified that they felt nervous, even scared, during the robbery.
Even without the explicit words in those specific instances.
Exactly. Even without those explicit verbal threats.
So Burnley's defense, as I understand it, was basically, hey, I didn't explicitly threaten violence in 3 of these robberies, so you can't convict me of robbery by intimidation for those ones. He was arguing his actions didn't meet the legal bar.
Precisely. His legal team argued that, legally speaking, intimidation requires a clear, direct threat of harm. And since he didn't make those kinds of overt threats in most of the robberies, they contended that the element of intimidation just wasn't present. Simple as that, from their perspective.
But the jury disagreed. They found him guilty on all counts anyway.
They did. The jury bought the prosecution's argument, found him guilty on all 4 counts, and that must have been what prompted the appeal to the 7th Circuit Court.
Makes sense.
Precisely. Burnley appealed, specifically challenging how the trial court interpreted intimidation under the federal bank robbery statute. That's, for listeners keeping score, 18 U.S.C. section 2113A.
Okay, so let's dive into that statute, section 2113A. It prohibits robbery by force, violence, or intimidation.
Oof.
That word intimidation is doing a lot of work here. Oh. Is it actually defined anywhere in the statute itself?
And that's a crucial point. It's not. The statute lists intimidation as one way to commit bank robbery, but it doesn't give a specific definition.
Huh.
So this is where the courts have to step in. They have to figure out what Congress actually meant by intimidation in the context of this particular law.
So the defense was saying, basically, no explicit threat, no intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the counter argument? What convinced the jury and then the 7th Circuit?
Well, the 7th Circuit's ruling really clarified things. They stated pretty clearly that you don't need an explicit direct threat for there to be legal intimidation.
Okay.
They focused instead on what's called an objective standard. It's not just about whether that specific teller felt intimidated subjectively, although, you know, their feelings can be evidence.
Right.
The key question is whether a reasonable person standing in that teller's shoes would have felt threatened by the defendant's conduct.
Okay, that makes sense. It's not just about the victim's personal state of mind, but how a typical person would likely react in that exact situation.
Mm.
So what specific things about Burnley's behavior made the court think a reasonable person would feel threatened?
Well, the court reasoned that Burnley's actions, taken together within the inherent context of a bank robbery, they implied that any resistance could lead to force.
Implied how?
Think about it.
Yeah.
He enters a bank, demands money, already an unusual, potentially dangerous event, and then he gives specific instructions about what not to include in the bag. He specifically mentions security measures like dye packs and bait bills.
Right, the warning.
Exactly. While he didn't say, if you put in a dye pack, I'll hurt you, the implication is definitely there. Why else bring it up? It suggests he's thought about it, he's prepared to deal with those security measures, which inherently carries a risk for the teller.
So, even though the words themselves weren't explicitly threatening, the whole situation, the robbery context, the specific instructions implied a potential for a bad outcome if the tellers didn't comply.
That's it, precisely. And this is where a precedent case called United States v. Gilmore comes into play, which the Seventh Circuit cited.
Okay, Gilmore, what did that establish?
Gilmore basically established that even seemingly polite demands made during a robbery can be considered intimidating. Why? Because of the inherently coercive nature of the situation itself. The very act of demanding money in a bank carries this sort of unspoken threat.
Right. The underlying understanding is always, I'm taking something that isn't mine, and if you try to stop me, well, something bad could happen.
Exactly, that unspoken potential for violence.
Yeah.
The court also noted that the teller's actual reactions, the fact they testified to being nervous and scared, and the fact they complied supported the idea that a reasonable person would have felt threatened. Their behavior indicated they perceived a real risk.
Now, you mentioned a procedural wrinkle earlier, something about Burnley's trial lawyer conceding the element of intimidation. How did that affect the appeal? That sounds like kind of a big deal.
Oh, it was a very significant strategic decision at trial. Because Burnley's lawyer conceded the point, essentially agreed that the government had proven intimidation, the appellate court reviewed that specific issue under a much tougher standard. It's called plain error.
Plain error. That sounds hard to meet.
It is. It's a very high legal hurdle. To get his conviction overturned based on that conceded point, Burnley would have had to show that the trial court's acceptance of that concession was not just wrong, but obviously glaringly wrong, and that it likely changed the entire outcome of the trial.
Wow. So by conceding that point, the lawyer basically made it much, much harder to win on appeal regarding the intimidation element.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It significantly tied the appellate court's hands on that issue. However, and this is really important, the Seventh Circuit actually went on to say that even if there hadn't been this concession at trial, the evidence presented was still sufficient to prove intimidation under their objective standard anyway. They emphasized that Burnley's instructions about the dye packs and bait bills weren't just, you know, polite requests. They were demands made during a robbery, specifically intended to create fear and ensure compliance.
That really reinforces their view then. They saw the entire situation as inherently intimidating, regardless of the specific words of the concession.
Exactly. The context of a bank robbery is just crucial here. When someone walks into a bank and demands money, a reasonable person behind that counter is almost certainly going to perceive a threat, even if that threat isn't shouted or explicitly verbalized with a weapon.
So let's really try to nail this down. What's the key takeaway here for understanding legal intimidation in bank robbery based on Burnley? What's the core principle the Seventh Circuit laid out?
The Seventh Circuit gave a very clear articulation, which is useful, they said. Intimidation exists when conduct is calculated to create the impression that any resistance would be met with force.
Calculated to create the impression.
Okay, let's unpack that for Burnley. Even though he was relatively calm in some robberies, his appearance, maybe a disguise, maybe just his demeanor, the act of handing over a bag, demanding money, and specifically warning against security measures, all of that together creates an impression.
An impression that he's in control and that, yeah, there would be negative consequences if they didn't do exactly what he said.
Precisely. The court's reasoning was that a reasonable teller would absolutely infer danger in that situation. You just don't need someone to explicitly say, give me the money or I'll shoot, for a reasonable person to feel threatened in that very specific context. The inherent nature of bank robbery itself kind of supplies that underlying potential for force.
And they also mentioned another case, United States v. Jones. What was that one about?
Right, Jones. In that case, the robber just passed a note that said something like, I have a gun. That note alone was considered sufficient for intimidation.
Ah, okay. So the court saw Burnley's actions, the demands, the warnings about dye packs, as conveying a similar implicit threat, even without mentioning a gun.
Exactly. While Burnley didn't explicitly claim to have a weapon in those three specific robberies, his actions and his demands created a comparable atmosphere. An atmosphere of potential danger, the possibility of force if the tellers didn't cooperate.
And that procedural lesson about his lawyer's concession at trial. That's also a really important practical point for, say, law students listening.
Oh, absolutely. The Burnley case really underscores the critical importance of challenging every element of a criminal charge at the trial level.
Don't give anything away easily.
Right. Conceding even what might seem like a difficult or maybe minor point can severely restrict your options later on appeal. By conceding intimidation, Burnley's defense strategy really limited the scope of what the appellate court could even look at effectively.
So the broader implication then for understanding intimidation in the law generally is that it's definitely not limited to just overt, explicit threats. It's a much more nuanced concept.
It really is.
It depends heavily on the surrounding circumstances, the whole context, and crucially, how a reasonable person would perceive those circumstances.
That's exactly right. Burnley demonstrates perfectly how legal definitions are often shaped and interpreted through case law, relying on these objective standards rather than just, you know, grabbing a dictionary. And it shows how those strategic choices made during legal proceedings can have huge lasting impacts on the final outcome.
So to really sum it up then.
Yeah.
The Burnley case confirms that even a bank robber who seems outwardly calm, who doesn't explicitly threaten violence, can still be convicted of robbery by intimidation.
Yes.
If their actions, viewed objectively within the whole context of the robbery, would reasonably lead a victim to believe that resistance could result in force.
That's a clear and accurate summary. The absence of an explicit threat doesn't automatically negate intimidation if the circumstances and the defendant's conduct combine to create that reasonable fear of potential force if the victim doesn't comply.
This has been a really fascinating look into how the law interprets even, well, seemingly straightforward terms like intimidation. It really makes you appreciate the depth involved.
It does, and it highlights why understanding not just the statute, but the case law and how these principles are applied to specific facts is just so critical for anyone studying or practicing law.
Definitely. So maybe a final thought for our listeners to chew on after this deep dive. Considering this Burnley ruling and the whole idea of objective intimidation, how might other actions, things that don't involve explicit threats, be interpreted as legally intimidating in totally different situations, not just bank robbery?
That's a great question.
It really opens up a lot of questions about how we perceive and legally define threats beyond just overt physical violence. Anyway, thanks for walking us through this case.
My pleasure. It's a really instructive one.